This is Ken Forrester, Executive Director at Momenta. Welcome to our Digital Thread podcast, produced by, for, and about digital industry leaders. In this series of conversations, we capture insights from the best and brightest minds in digital industry. They're executives, entrepreneurs, advisors, and other thought leaders. What they have in common is, like our team at Momenta, they are deep industry operators. We hope you find these podcasts informative. And as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. Good day and welcome to Momenta Digital Thread podcast series. Today, I am greatly pleased to host Andrew Lamb, Chair, Internet of Production Alliance, dedicated to revolutionizing manufacturing through decentralized and distributed networks. Andrew is on a mission to enhance traditional mass production with the concept of production by the masses. Over two decades, he's focused on international development aid and humanitarian disaster relief, venturing into areas that globalized supply chains find challenging to access. His work has revolved around localizing solutions by harnessing the power of 3D printing, digital fabrication, makerspaces, and conventional manufacturing techniques. These innovations have produced critical humanitarian aid items in response to conflicts, natural calamities, and ongoing crisis. Andrew's at the forefront of building the essential infrastructure and initiating systemic changes necessary to facilitate distributed manufacturing. His multifaceted role encompasses consulting with and advocating for governments and donors, influencing the global maker movement, collaborating with national manufacturing and engineering organizations, and setting industry standards, codes, best practices, and guidelines. Andrew contributes to multiple foundations, including the Apropedia Foundation, and presides over two companies, Massive Small Manufacturing in the United Kingdom and Distributed Manufacturing in Kenya. These enterprises reflect his dedication to reshaping manufacturing landscapes both globally and locally. Andrew earned a Master of Engineering from the University of Cambridge. Andrew, welcome to our Digital Thread podcast today.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure. And honestly, thank you for these podcasts as well. I'm very grateful for the insights you bring.
I really appreciate that. Look, we've taken, as of the last probably year or two, talk about our focus as Momenta really moving from digital industry to industrial impact. And I think a lot of the Industry 5.0 initiative had us really thinking about the outcomes and the impact, right? And when I started to understand, and I think it was the EU Commission, the gentleman who leads Industry 5 there, who referred me to you, I really realized the value of impact in the sense of how you're creating that. And so I've been long since waiting to have this conversation with you, and I think you'll be a great addition to certainly the lineups of people that we've had. So as you know, we call this the Digital Thread podcast. And so my first question always is, what would you consider to be your digital thread?
I think for me, it's about systems that are open and distributed or decentralized, and that empower everyone. I was born in 1982, so I've seen the way things, I experienced the way things were before the internet and then after the internet, and I found the internet really quite inspiring because it's open and enabled distributed and decentralized systems to emerge. And yeah, that sense of transformational empowerment, of being able to empower everyone, that's the promise of open distributed systems, in my view.
I like that analogy. Basically, what's happened in the digital space, you're looking to recreate in the physical space of manufacturing. And, exactly. And certainly, that's a great mandate to have. I noted, you know, one of your early defining roles after graduating Cambridge was CEO of Engineers Without Borders. And I must say, I hadn't heard of the organization before the conversation with you. So I'm really interested. Can you tell us a bit about the organization, your focus within it?
It's a wonderful organization, and it really changed my life. And I think it's changed the lives of many thousands of engineers, but also people in developing countries all over the world. It started as a student club. And I was struggling with my engineering degree. I was having difficulty with all of the maths and not a lot of application. And the Millennium Development Goals were very much in the zeitgeist at the time. And there was a student club called Engineers Without Borders that wanted to share some of the skills that we were learning in the lecture halls to bring water and energy and agriculture, food, and all sorts of, to bring those sorts of technologies, to bring access to that technology to people living in poverty. And it started out as that sort of idea of a little bit like the Doctors Without Borders or Médecins Sans Frontières, where you share the skills, where you bring access to technologies. But over time, it became very much about the engineer themselves, and that, you know, universities train us to be engineers, but there was a sense in which the world was not linear. The world was not, things didn't always go to plan. And so we needed to be not just engineers, but we had to become engineers without borders to deal with the complexity that we experience in the world. And now we started getting involved in engineering education. So we did a lot of work around engineering education reform. And now Engineers Without Borders is working hard to almost change the definition of what it means to be an engineer, looking at concepts of global responsibility so that any new technology, any new infrastructure or building or car that is built is responding to the challenges that we're facing on this small planet. And for me, an important moment with Engineers Without Borders was looking at the question of scale. We know how to solve the world's problems, access to water, growing food, access to energy, renewable energy. It's a question of how do you reach scale? And we came up with this idea of decentralized networks of appropriate technologies that local people could maintain. And it led to the concept of massive small change. So rather than doing big infrastructure projects, we would do, you know, like building a power station, we would try to build networks of renewable energy suppliers in microgrids where that people could maintain and operate themselves. And that's when I really got into the difference that that sort of systems approach could make in people's lives.
You know, the analogy, of course, Doctors Without Borders typically would imply a geographic borders, right? And in some sense, yes. I love the fact that you took this up a level to talk about kind of the conceptual borders that our engineering profession typically fits within, right? As you say, large infrastructure projects traditionally done by probably a top-down hierarchical engineering organization or, you know, set of construction. Yeah. And so it's very interesting the way that you're approaching this overall. Look, I know you've contributed your leadership to several humanitarian organizations, so UNESCO, World Bank Group, Redder in the UK, also focused on engineering-related endeavors in each of these cases. So truly applying engineering skills into, I'll call it the geographic border, if you will, opportunities. So what attracted you to this intersection of humanitarian goals and manufacturing skill?
I'm someone who's motivated by anger. I'm not really motivated by love. Like, I'm very much sort of a person that's, you know, I want to solve problems. I find it really difficult to to not solve a problem. You know, if I come across these problems, I feel really motivated or feel angry about it, and I want to do something about it. And there's a lot to be angry about the inequalities that we have on this earth, the incredible inequalities that we have, even in our own towns, wherever we may be, let alone across the continents. But for me, there was a really obvious thing, which I felt like the international development and aid communities had forgotten. How is a country supposed to develop if it doesn't have engineers? And what we've seen in Asia is an enormous investment in the 60s and 70s and 80s in engineering and manufacturing education. And we're seeing the fruits of that investment now. But in many countries in the world, technical and engineering education, manufacturing skills has sort of been left behind in favor of other programs. And I honestly, I think that has increased many countries' dependency on aid because they're not able to make things for themselves. So it is this sort of trying to solve the problem of poverty, of resilience to disasters. And in fact, now the humanitarian system has a paradigm where we are exacerbating problems. So if there is a major crisis, a disaster, we're often importing supplies and giving them away for free. And that depresses the local markets. I've been in factories that were not destroyed necessarily by a hurricane, but were destroyed by the aid response, by giving away free stuff that was donated internationally, rather than buying locally made things. And that it lost its business because of the aid response. So in some ways, I was angry about how the aid sector can have unintended consequences. So the thing about manufacturing is change with a business model. And that's why I've chosen at this point in my life to focus on the manufacturing sector.
It sounds like a good lead-in to the Internet of Production, which you founded in 2019. So what is the origin story for this organization and what is its focus?
I think it's in digital fabrication, digital manufacturing. So the archetype of which is the 3D printer. And for someone in the humanitarian sector, in the aid sector, as I was, really, I came across it because of the maker movement. So maker spaces and, you know, people with 3D printers, people being able to make things. Honestly, if you're an aid worker in a remote part of the Himalayas in Nepal, as I was after the 2015 earthquakes, it is incredibly difficult to get a spare part. But if you could just make your own and then use that 3D printer to make the next thing, a medical device perhaps, and then the next thing, perhaps something to connect water pipes together or something, you can use digital fabrication to embrace this sort of economies of scope approach. But those remote communities don't need economies of scale. They don't need mass production. What they need is lots of different things, ideally available pretty much on demand. And that's really hard with globalized supply chains. So we got into transforming supply chains, and Field Ready, the organization I was with, got involved in co-founding the Internet of Production, which was all about trying to create networks of local manufacturers and makers in order to fulfill large orders because of this question of scale again. The scale of the problem was so big, 3D printing one medical device at a time wasn't going to get you very far. Now, it could save a life, that 3D print. I know that we've done 3D prints that have saved lives, but how does it scale? And so the question of the Internet of Production emerged, where you could create networks of local manufacturers in the same way, and to share hardware designs in the same way that the internet shares knowledge and information and content, and can enable people to produce their own knowledge and information and content and share that with the world. We were going to try and do the same. But what we realized was that the infrastructures for distributed, decentralized manufacturing didn't really exist. The infrastructures we have in the manufacturing sector have been defined, and the way we work in the manufacturing sector has been defined by the first industrial revolution and mass production. And that has brought enormous benefits and enormous quality of life and being able to create incredibly complex products very, very cheaply. But it doesn't get everywhere. The effect is that it's making wealthy people wealthier and leaving more and more people behind. So it's kind of, if we can decentralize and distribute manufacturing through an internet of production with open infrastructures, then it'll empower everyone to be able to realize their own recoveries from disaster, but to also sort of determine their own development and start their own businesses and their own livelihoods and be less dependent on aid.
Do you have some examples of notable wins that the Internet of Production has had?
Sure. I mean, they're not necessarily the wins of the Internet of Production as such, in the sense that this is, the Internet of Production is currently being created by an alliance of organizations. So they're the wins of our members using the ideas and the infrastructures of the Internet of Production. So some of the examples are from companies like Kijenzi, which is a Kenyan company that's actually using 3D printers. It's like a 3D printer farm to manufacture either one product at a time for local health centers or tens or hundreds of thousands of products for the automotive companies or whatever. And, you know, this is on the shores of Lake Victoria in Kenya. You could also look at, you know, the adoption of some of the data standards that we've created. We had a data standard that we nicknamed Open Know-How. You might have heard of open data or open knowledge, but open know-how was trying to embrace the challenge that know-how is really hard to share on the internet, or even, you know, it's often in the form of videos. So it's, you might see YouTube videos on how to make something, how to fix something, how to repair something, or you'd see these TV shows that are all about DIY or even making food or whatever, you know, the cooking shows. Know-how is really hard to share digitally, except with video. So the purpose of the Open Know-How standard was to make it easier to discover know-how that existed, well-documented designs or hardware, whether that hardware is proprietary or open source hardware. And then a number of platforms have adopted this data standard because it really helps to be able to not reinvent the wheel, basically, to not have to spend all of that time redesigning something that already exists. We also have a map of machines. You can go to map.internetofproduction.org, and we're building a map of all of the world's machines, which is an ambitious goal, but it really highlights to the world what manufacturing capabilities exist, even in places that I don't expect. But I have to say the biggest win was the pandemic response. We saw millions and millions and millions of items of PPE being made in makerspaces, in fab labs, by people in their own homes and providing that to local markets. This morning I was visiting the fabrication laboratory, the fab lab in Kigali. I'm in Rwanda today. And the fab lab here in Rwanda made 2 million face shields on contract with the government of Rwanda and various supermarkets, because basically Rwanda was at the bottom of the food chain when it came to getting PPE during the pandemic response, but distributed manufacturing stepped in. It's hard to show how many lives were saved by that kind of intervention, but it really is an extraordinary. The pandemic response really showed people not only how fragile supply chains are, but the need for more resilience and more local distributed manufacturing. You know, you get resilience through networks, and that's what we're trying to build.
You know, it's interesting, as you were talking about the kind of historical manufacturing or industrialization, right? Originally around sources of propulsion or energy, right? Rivers per se, right? Cotton mills and such. Then around naturally where there was supply, think, you know, mines, metallurgy, et cetera. And of course, demand. But demand has always been the one that's probably been the most flexible in that, given that, you know, we've had global supply chains, you know, pulling from Asia to send to North America for generations.
Yeah,
but the piece that was missing in all of that, assume, you know, we could decentralize energy. Well, we've done that, right? Ultimately, that has already happened. Decentralize the supply. And in many of these cases, especially with circular economy approaches, right, the steady supply of either metal or the materials to do 3D printing are generally available pretty much anywhere. You know, demand, you can still decentralize, but skills and know-how, as you said, was the one thing that we haven't done a good job of decentralizing yet. Ironically, that's what the internet has, at least from a digital infrastructure perspective, has provided the infrastructure to do. And so I can see how all of this is coming together. And I like the fact you keep iterating it about resilience. And clearly, the pandemic would have clearly shown what the pecking order of demand is in terms of who gets what, right?
Yeah.
I remember some of the battles over PPE during that time, even between, quote, modern Western European countries, right?
And remember that in order to win those battles, we as populations paid way over the odds of what it would normally have been, sort of thing. So, you know, sure, we could have potentially afforded. I mean, we've got enormous national debts in the West, but we can afford to incur those debts, perhaps. But we are going to suffer for it as well. And I think we could really learn from countries that haven't benefited from globalization to the same extent about how they responded to the manufacture of PPE to inform the way that we might respond to future pandemics and future supply chain failures, making things locally. And that's where some ideas and conversations in the manufacturing sector are going these days, I think.
Well, you know, in some sense, we often talk about this trend of reshoring now. You know, you hear it quite a bit, especially relative to North America and Europe. And in some sense, it is an outcome of the pandemic, right? And severed supply chains. It's also, of course, very geopolitical, as you can imagine, too. But it's interesting that within there is a sourcing strategy we often hear about within this reshoring initiative, and that's about 4X by X. And you typically hear it as in, I'm a manufacturer, so what I'm going to make for China, I'm going to make in China effectively, right?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of a guideline about where you should be effectively sourcing your materials and products from. To what degree are you seeing Africa benefit from both the reshoring trend, but more importantly, this kind of four Africa by Africa approach?
Well, I think the impact of the Internet of Production is going to be biggest where supply chains are at their worst. And supply chains, globalized supply chains, are at their worst in places that have small populations, in remote areas, and or that are places that have low levels of income, or resource-constrained places. So globalized supply chains serve London, my hometown, very well. It doesn't necessarily serve the islands of off the coast of Scotland very well. And there are certainly rural communities across Africa in small populations with low purchasing power that aren't being served very well. I think the way that Africa is going to benefit is that Africa has absolutely incredible latent talent And what's interesting is that that talent is mobilizing itself. So you see these young African entrepreneurs teaching themselves manufacturing and making skills, digital design skills, learning about hardware and product design, learning about business models. And it fits into a narrative of made in Uganda, made in South Africa, made in, you know, there is a political moment taking place where that's beginning to converge. Now, there are still institutional systems, not least helping these people out with things like cash flow so they can invest in machines and so on, just practical things like that. There are still the institutional barriers that need to be overcome so that you can really unleash that talent. And one of the things I'm really passionate about, I'm involved in a project called the MAKE Project, which is about African and European makerspace ecosystems. And there are some amazing innovative products being manufactured in Africa, which really should be on the market in Europe. But rather than shipping them, we need to connect together the designers in African countries with the makers and the manufacturers in Europe to share the designs digitally, but then also to make sure that, you know, the original designers also get paid for their work, for their labor. And I think the Internet of Production will enable that. So it's kind of, there's an opportunity for Africa to really leapfrog the industrial revolutions that we've had in the West. But let's take a moment to just recognize that manufacturing in the world in general depends on natural resources that exist in Africa. And I think there's an opportunity here for African countries to really mobilize their young people and to use their own resources to transform their economies and transform the opportunities for the people across the continent.
Yeah, thank you for the reminder around the natural resources. As we were contrasting earlier about supply and availability of raw materials, Africa certainly would rate very high. And the West clearly has taken advantage of that for centuries. Let's kind of shift gears a little bit and talk about smart manufacturing initiative. And specifically, over the past decade or so, there you've had Industry 4.0, now Industry 5.0, Digital Thread in the U.S., a great little initiative called Shoestring Digital Manufacturing in the UK that I really like. Let me ask, how would you compare and contrast your efforts to these? Where's the Venn of how all of these can work together?
I think the Internet of Production idea is, I would conceptualize it as being horizontal. It can be for the individual maker or the biggest industrial manufacturers. And it's about not necessarily scaling up production, but scaling out production. So massive numbers of small manufacturers working across a network. So in that sense, it's horizontal. You might have an identical product being made by 200 different organizations all on the same contract, because those manufacturers are local to where the demand is. So you could have this sort of horizontal type approach. And I would characterize the different types of manufacturing initiatives as being more vertical. So certainly I've seen a lot of vertical integration of supply chains since the pandemic, but there's the idea that supply chains are at the moment, well, just that, linear sort of vertical supply chains. And what we are trying to create is supply networks and some ways of manufacturing that is more resilient in the form of supply networks. So Industry 4.0, I think, to contrast with that, to me, ultimately, that was about better matching supply to demand. I mean, there's a lot, of course, in the concept of Industry 4.0 around digital systems and more automated systems that allow you to customize to the individual customer. You know, I think that that is still seen as something you would do through a single platform or through a single factory or through a single tool chain. Whereas I'm thinking more about, in the Internet of Production, about expanding that across that single tool chain. With Industry 5.0, the contribution to society and welfare, well, that would certainly be there because essentially it shares the love. I mean, the network, this would be bringing manufacturing contracts to small manufacturers local to where the demand is, rather than having to compete with imports. That isn't just a social motivation. This is about making money as well, right? This is about being properly compensated for your labor. But what you'd find is that you have a slightly more level playing field, because for a lot of people, particularly in more distributed or remote communities, the cost of the product isn't really the shelf price. The bulk of the cost of the product is the supply chain cost. So if you're buying a pen or a piece of stationery or something, and it's being shipped over from India to here in Rwanda, then most of the cost of that product is in the supply chain, which creates an enormous opportunity to be able to compete if you can manufacture it locally. With digital thread, it's about these, again, I think that's about vertical supply chains. And actually, you know, the Shoestring project I've been watching with great interest, not only because it's one of the inclinations of it is at the University of Cambridge, but that's about helping smaller manufacturers to embrace digital technologies in the manufacturing sector, just as the large manufacturers have. And I think we are quite aligned with that. But in that case, a lot of that is being focused on upskilling manufacturers that are in wealthier countries and not necessarily integrating them through networks as well. So to be honest with you, I really hope the Internet of Production will be able to add something to all of these manufacturing initiatives.
Yeah, I think there clearly is a good Venn between a lot of those. On Shoestring, interesting enough, I was thinking there is a leapfrog effect that I think Africa, certainly with the telecom revolution, experienced once already, right? The ability to go over legacy 2G, 3G networks and go right for some of the longer range high-speed ones, mainly because they didn't have the legacy to worry about. In some sense, I think the challenge with Shoestring is they're dealing with largely manual production manufacturers, at least in their home market of UK to begin with, who have the same amount of legacy, right? And so in some sense, there might be another leapfrog ability for Africa, particularly around the digitization, as you say, 3D printing, shared design files, know-how, things like that. But I do like Shoestring in the sense that it is distributing know-how, to your point, right? And going after the long tail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really important. And there's, you know, manufacturing any product takes an enormous amount to do it really well and to do it in a way that makes profit. Takes a lot of effort and a lot of specialized skill. And I think that those sorts of projects, like the Shoestring project, need to happen all over the world. And I really hope that our alliance can find ways to mobilize resources into those sorts of initiatives in the future.
Yep. No, fully agreed. Look, I know you're the chair of Fab Lab Winam, a vibrant makerspace in Kisumu, Kenya.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about that, the impact that you're having there?
Yeah, fabrication laboratories were a type of makerspace that emerged from MIT. And Fab Lab Winam is the local name for the town of Kisumu. What's interesting about Fab Lab Winam is that it's a developing country makerspace that isn't in a capital city. And a lot of makerspaces that you'll see are in really big cities in developing countries. Kisumu is not a big city. It's a medium-sized city. And I think it's maybe the third largest in Kenya, third or fourth. And so what made it really interesting to me is a place where we can learn about how we can bring makerspaces and manufacturing capabilities to new kinds of markets around the world. The impact of it, I mean, the skills, it's skills and livelihoods. I think whether they were making things during the pandemic, they were making PPE during the pandemic for local health facilities, we're seeing young women who perhaps haven't had the chance to even finish school are now able to go into the space and be able to make things, learn new skills. It's almost like a sort of remedial education service. But we're also seeing engineering students who are doing formal education courses coming into the Fab Lab because in their formal education courses, they're not allowed to touch the machines. They're not allowed to use the machines for doing demonstrations. And if you're being cynical, they are to show visiting guests. Like, they're not necessarily to be used by the students to be creative and to prototype things. So I think one of the things that really attracted me, though, to Fab Lab Winam was the founder of it, Martin Olu. And he's become a good friend. He's actually here with me in Kigali on the trip. He's not a maker, necessarily. He's not an engineer. His background is in social work. So he created Fab Lab Winam as a new way to tackle some of the problems that he discovered in Kisumu whilst he was a social worker with the government. And I think that's just fascinating to me. And it really shows the remit of the impacts of Fab Lab Winam.
What a great story and what a great learning laboratory, especially given the fact that, as you say, it's not in a major city there.
Yeah.
Let me ask, how does somebody learn more about the Internet of Production and some of your other efforts?
I think The Internet of Production website, internetofproduction.org, is the place to go to learn about the Alliance. We're just about to launch a rebrand. Perhaps that might have happened by the time the podcast comes out. And we're going to get some more stories of the thinking that goes into it out into the world. But the best way is to speak to some of our Alliance members, or speak to us, and we can introduce you to some of the Alliance members. We have a pretty good awareness of what's going on in lots of different parts of the world. So if you're looking for someone who's interested or doing Internet of Productions type things in your local area, I'm sure we'd be able to help find someone. So do reach out to us, info@internetofproduction.org. And, I'm really interested to engage people in the Alliance as well. So please do get in touch and see if you're interested in joining.
Perfect. That's excellent. So I always like to close this up by asking, where do you find your personal inspiration?
There is a community I'm part of called the Global Innovation Gallery, and that brings together innovators from around the world who are really quite amazing, extraordinary people. It's a community that embraces sort of nonlinear, that embraces complexity and emergence, that really embraces failure and learning from failure, and embraces collaboration. And that's something that I think it's quite hard to find in my world over the last 20 years in the aid sector, where everything has been about projects and project management and very linear. You know, we have project management frameworks like theory of change or logical framework analysis that we use. And it's all very, you have to plan. Like, I remember writing budgets where I had to get a quote for a flight 3 years in advance because it was a 3-year project. And it was madness. Honestly, don't mean to suck up. I really enjoy your podcast. I think there's been some amazing people on here, and I always learn things from it. I'm really interested in complexity in cybernetics. So I'm involved in groups like the UK Cybernetics Society and follow the work of David Snowden and the Canevin Company. There's a series of books by an author, Matthew Crawford, in the US. And I think in the US, it's called Shopcraft to Soulcraft. In the UK, the book is called The Case for Working with Your Hands. And then the subtitle is Why Office Work is Bad for You. And it's a very, very thoughtful insight into the value of making things. But yeah, honestly, the biggest inspiration is the people I meet, their struggle and their ability to innovate, even in the most constrained and difficult circumstances.
Well, that's wonderful. And you certainly have made an impact on so many people already. And I can see how you're scaling up to do even more. So, Andrew, thank you for sharing this time and these wonderful insights with us today.
Well, thanks for this opportunity. It really is a great opportunity. And, it's kind of an important moment for the Internet to Production, because we are engaging with mainstream manufacturing more and more. And we want to try and make sure that what we do really does empower everyone. You don't have to be a makerspace in Kisumu to benefit from the Internet of Production. And I really hope that your listeners will find some value in what we're doing. Thank you.
And thank you very much. So this has been Andrew Lamb, chair of the Internet of Production Alliance. And if I may say, a gentleman who is truly representing industrial impact and the manufacturing impact that we can all have. Thank you for listening, and please join us for the next episode of our Digital Thread podcast series. We wish you a momentous day. You've been listening to the Momenta Digital Thread podcast series. We hope you've enjoyed the discussion, and as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. Please check our website at momenta.one for archive versions of podcasts, as well as resources to help with your digital industry journey. Thank you for listening.